You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, November 9th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, David Dayan from Fire Dog Lake News. On the elections yesterday, broadly speaking, and the changes in the White House, and the Affordable Care Act ruling coming out of a very conservative district court. Also on the program today, Amanda Turkle on the defeat. Of SB 5 in Ohio. All that and more. We got some results in from Bank Transfer Day. Global warming. Results from around the country. A good day if you believe in liberal, progressive, leftist, labor, workers, consumers, human beings across the spectrum. All that and more. A little bit of house cleaning. I neglected to mention this on the lesser half of the show yesterday. I did mention it on the better half of the show. The reason why we didn't have Glenn Greenwald on Monday, turns out he had a medical issue and was in the hospital. He's fine now, but we will reschedule his appearance on this program in the very near future. Now, I know many of you, if you followed any of the results, are quite happy today. In Mississippi, the attempt to make a zygote a person failed. Wreaking havoc on all of the entrepreneurs looking to sell products to zygotes. And we will get into that. But, you know, there's another take on this, folks. And I don't know if this is going to maybe perhaps have you reconsider your perspective on this. This is audio from Phil Bryant. He was the Mississippi Lieutenant Governor. He is the co-chair of the Yes on Amendment 26. He was voted in to be the next governor, but this is what he had to say on the eve of the vote to make zygotes people.
Governor, and so we are making tremendous strides. Now, this is a battle of good and evil, and let's just make it plain. This the evil side, the dark side of the forces, the Satan and those that would love to continue to kill children while still in the womb are out there using every effort that they can, anything at their disposal. Now, even in these times, if you talk too much about the fact that evil does exist, people will think, oh, well, there's something wrong with him. What times are we living in when it is politically incorrect for someone to say Satan has a hand in this? And you've got to understand, we've got to fight against the gates of hell to prevail here. And that's exactly what I've been saying, and I hope people will. I think when I say those things, I see people recognizing the fact that this is a biblical battle of good and evil.
But you know, I would suggest to the governor-elect that when he says those things, the look that he's seeing on those people's face is not one necessarily of recognition, but one where they're thinking to themselves, oh, my God, this guy's going to be our governor. Now, of course, the bad news here is that Satan won yesterday in Mississippi on this ballot measure. I don't know, but I suspect this could have implications for Christmas. I don't know if Satan can call off Christmas, or if Satan wins on something like this, that Christmas, nobody gets presents, everybody just gets cold. I don't know. But this is, I would prepare your children now. Because if they find out Christmas morning, well, Satan won in Mississippi, and so Santa Claus didn't bring any gifts, they're going to be pissed. So that's a public service announcement. We will take a break, come back with David Dayan just after this break. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. David Dayan, the editor of the news blog on Fire Dogs Lake. Fire Dog Lake, is that the is that your proper title, David?
You know, whatever you want to call me is perfectly fine.
You should also
you probably have a better conception of what my job is than I do.
I'll tell you something. I am always I say this every time you come on. And I am always just stunned by how many things you cover and how intelligently you cover them and comment on them. I also got to tell you that if you replace the first one in your number with a 7 accidentally and you try and call you, you get someone who has 3 different businesses. One of them seems to be a lactation consultancy. So just
that's I can't say I was aware of that. My coverage does not extend that far.
Well, there you go. I mean, I thought I wanted to be able to tell you something you didn't know today, and now I feel like
exactly.
I
now you have. Now
you have. All right. So let's first. I want to talk first about the just in broadly speaking the results. We're going to be talking to Amanda Turkle specifically about SB5 later in the mm-hmm. program, but I want to talk about the results last night, broadly speaking, because you characterize them as a good election for rear guard actions for liberals. What did you mean by both rear guard and liberals, as opposed to, let's say, Democrats?
Well, I said liberals because most of the high profile elections that were on the ballot didn't really feature Democrats. They were over initiatives. They were over initiatives where there was a clear conservative extreme attempt to push forward an agenda that was clearly broadly unacceptable. In Mississippi, we saw the personhood amendment go down. That would have defined life as beginning at conception. You mentioned SB 5, which is the anti-union assault on workers' rights in Ohio, which has now been repealed. In Maine, there was an attempt to roll back same-day registration, which has been in place for four decades. In Arizona, Russell Pierce, who was the architect of SB 1070, the very extreme immigration law, he was recalled and replaced by a moderate Republican in the extremely red district. So the unifying theme that I saw was, you know, conservative overreach and a backlash. So that is a defensive or rear guard action by liberals to stop a furtherance of a conservative agenda on a number of fronts. At the same time, it sort of maintained the status quo rather than provided, you know, any new kind of benefit or an advance of any progressive agenda. It was a stop of, you know, the putting of the finger in the dike, really, of what we've seen since 2010 in terms of this Tea Party conservative resurgence. But clearly what the voters said in many states last night is that they didn't want any part of such an extreme agenda, and they wanted to roll it back a bit.
You know, it's stunning to me, because if you look at these, if we list these things, okay, anti-immigration, anti-immigration, the attack on unions and collective bargaining, the ideas, I guess, I mean, those two elements of the Republican agenda seem like they are right down the middle almost of what the Republican agenda is across the country. You know what I mean? I mean,
absolutely.
These are extreme in the context of the United States, but in terms of the Republican Party, and not to mention, there was also a lot of victories against anti-gay forces, it seemed to me.
Yes, I should have got into that. In Iowa, there was a gambit by the Republican governor to try to capture the state Senate. What he did was he appointed a moderate Democrat to a position in his administration in the attempt to trigger a special election that, if successful on the Republican side, would have put the state Senate in the hands of the Republicans. And because gay marriage or marriage equality, I should say, is legal in Iowa, there was a thinking that this was the last bastion, that the Republicans would then move to pass a constitutional amendment, which would need a referendum too, but they would start that process if they captured the state Senate. Well, they didn't. Liz Mathis, the Democrat, won, and won pretty decisively. There was an effort in Maine, and I'm sure you are aware of this, to tie the same-day registration vote to the gays, and that this was the way that they would further their gay agenda somehow, that it was, you know, we had to roll back same-day registration. This was literally one of the arguments on the side of conservatives in that race, and that went down. So, yes. I think you could characterize
They're making it that classic gay procrastination argument, which we know.
Exactly. You can definitely make a case that last night represented a defeat for the Republican Party platform.
Yeah, I mean, that's the amazing thing. I mean, if you take anti-gay, anti-choice, anti-union, anti-labor, broadly speaking, and you take those away from the Republican Party as a way of driving out their base. I mean, I guess you still have, you know, anti-Muslim that they have in their quiver, an anti-foreign-born president. But, I mean, do they have much left after that?
Well, I mean, it's true that you know, liberals, and why I say liberals is because these were largely initiatives, were broadly successful in holding on to some of these gains and fending off a conservative surge on all of these fronts. But also, you know, the Virginia State Senate appears to have gone to Republicans, mm-hmm. and that means they have full control of the agenda in Virginia, which could be a very negative outcome. In Mississippi, at the same time that personhood went down, a very restrictive photo ID law passed, and passed pretty easily. In Ohio, at the same time that issue two was going down, issue three passed, and that was this sort of mythical thing to invalidate the Obama health care law, and specifically the individual mandate, and say that Ohio citizens don't have to aren't forced to buy health insurance. It has no actual enforcement. But so, you know, that's why I kind of characterize this as rear guard actions. It's sort of this relentlessness of the conservatives to forward their agenda, and they got stopped on a number of fronts, but a few of them pushed through. And it's sort of this constant defensiveness, you know, because of what happened in 2010 and sort of the you know, resurgence of conservatives everywhere. Hopefully, this is the beginning of the turning of a tide in that respect, and I think there are reasons to believe it is. But it's sort of, you know, just keeping on the treadmill and the status quo and not progressing in any material way yet.
All right. So let me and I want to touch back. I want to circle back on that mandate vote to talk about the ruling that took place yesterday. Yeah. But before we do that, do you think, you know, when you tie in the change in rhetoric that President Obama has been using since, let's say, around Labor Day, the departure of Bill Daley from the White House this past week, and the sort of the clear message that was sent by, you know, what happens when you attack labor. And the implications for this vote in Ohio is pretty strong in Cincinnati, say, where you had essentially the city council shift to Democrats. You had four, I think, Republicans lose in Cincinnati. What are the implications of this, broadly speaking, in terms of what we're going to see from the administration going forward?
I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. Daley wasn't he was demoted. He wasn't dismissed. He's still sort of hanging around as the liaison to the corporate world. And to the extent that Daley's been successful at all, it's been getting certain corporate priorities forward, whether it's trade deals or the elimination of ozone standards. It was extremely instrumental in both of those deals. And I assume that he'll continue to be this sort of parking ticket fixer for corporate America within the White House. So that's still going to continue. You're absolutely right. There's been a change in focus, a change in rhetoric, and maybe just sort of an understanding that this Republican Party cannot bargain with, even though that was sort of the agenda after the 2010 elections. Certainly the Obama administration, you could see, was kind of rerunning 1995 and 1996 in the Clinton era, bringing back all these Clinton veterans to try and triangulate and come up with a way to move an agenda forward. What he found was that he's not as good at dealing with Republicans who don't want to deal with him. So there has been that shift. And I think it's a shift that's broadly reflective of the shift you're seeing in the country when you have thousands of people sitting in public parks and occupying and in the streets and demanding direct action. You're going to see that reflected in the politics. And I think that's part of what happened last night. And it's part of what's happening inside Washington.
Do you think not only are the implications for this for the administration, but this is really going to impact, or do you think it's going to impact the super committee? I mean, we have, like, Schumer, I think, came out yesterday and said, we're going to be tougher negotiators than Obama was. I mean, it seems like there is at least an attempt now to project an image of Democrats being a little bit, their spines seem to have been stiffened. I mean, for the past month or so, we've seen the impact of Occupy Wall Street on the broader narrative. But, you know, we have Blumenthal yesterday questioning Eric Holder about why you haven't prosecuted any bankers. We have Schumer coming out saying that we're not going to be pushovers like President Obama. All of this seems to be having an incredibly immediate impact on Democratic politicians. We're seeing the implications of this and Occupy Wall Street on the super committee as well.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me, I mean, do you think, I mean, it's been pretty stunning how quickly Democrats seem to have responded to these sea changes, at least in the context of what's happened with Occupy Wall Street over the past month. I mean, it's almost as if it hit a tipping point because they were completely unresponsive, it seems to me, prior to now.
I agree. As far as the super committee is concerned, I think it was just destined to fail. You know, they were not going over any different issues than were going over. They were going over, you know, during the negotiations on the debt limit, and Republicans showed themselves completely unwilling to budge on the tax issue. The interesting thing now is that they're pretending, they feel right. the need to exactly. pretend to relent in some way on taxes, even though they're not. They have this so-called concession on capping deductions that would bring $300 billion in, according to them. But they want that in exchange for permanently extending the Bush tax cuts, which would cost $3.7 trillion. So their concession on taxes is to cut them by $3.4 trillion.
Right.
Yeah. So,
but it is interesting to me
interesting,
that they – yes.
Yeah. I mean, this is what I was going to say, and I'm sure you're going to say. What's interesting is that they feel the need mm-hmm. to present a pose of reasonableness, which they certainly haven't prior to this. On the tax issue, they felt like they could not be rigid on that issue. Eric Cantor went out and gave a speech on income inequality, even though he didn't mention income inequality in the speech. The headline was that it was a speech about income inequality. There's certainly been a shift in the conversation and where that's landed over the last 2 months, and I think it's a direct result of what Occupy Wall Street has been able to do. They've really shifted the narrative and the thinking in the country, and that's been reflected in Washington in a way that liberals and progressives haven't been able to do, I'd say, over the last 30 years.
Yeah, it's been stunning, and the implications, I mean, every day there are more implications coming from Occupy Wall Street, whether it's impacting the rhetoric of the Republicans, whether it's impacting the rhetoric of the Democrats, whether it's impacting the behavior and the disposition of unions becoming more aggressive.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so we're watching this around the country. Now, I just want to double back to the mandate vote in Ohio. The Ohio voted essentially to release them from the implications of the Affordable Care Act. But like you said, that's largely a moot vote because this is going to be determined in the Supreme Court. But this week, we had a pretty – how would you characterize this decision coming out of this pretty conservative court?
Groundbreaking. You're talking about the D.C. Circuit
right.
Court of Appeals, which voted to uphold the individual mandate in a three-judge panel, two of whom were appointed by Republicans. The main judge writing the opinion, Lawrence Silberman, is a very conservative Reagan appointee. The dissenter was Brett Kavanaugh, who's a George W. Bush appointee, but he didn't even dissent by saying that the individual mandate was unconstitutional. He dissented on the issue of standing, saying that the people who sued to block the mandate didn't have a right to sue yet because they hadn't been taxed. But Silberman's argument really kind of, you know, said that the individual mandate is within the bounds of the Commerce Clause. It may sound novel, but this has been done before in sort of other respects, and you know, he did not buy the conservative line on this. And
in fact, I mean, Silberman actually went further. It seems to me he actually fully embraced the administration's line that the health insurance, he wrote, the health insurance market is a rather unique one, both because virtually everyone will enter it or affect it. And because uninsured inflict a disproportionate harm on the rest of the market as a result of their later consumption of healthcare services. I mean, this is not just an argument, I think, in support of the Affordable Care Act in terms of the Commerce Clause. I mean, I think this is also the argument as to why there should be a single payer health insurance program by the government, because it is in a very unique has a very unique function within the context of society.
Right. And what he also did is really sort of warn the conservative judicial movement, saying that, you know, be careful what you wish for, because what you have to do if you invalidate this is you have to invalidate most of the things that government does. And I know that's probably a something devoutly to be wished by some levels of the conservative community. But that is a serious legal problem. You'd have to be throwing out decades upon decades of precedent and essentially roll back the New Deal, and it's a very radical step. And Silberman, at least, wasn't willing to do it. Now, this is the second judge appointed by a Republican who has basically upheld the mandate as constitutional. Of course, all of this is going to matter in this, isn't going to matter unless Anthony Kennedy agrees. You know, the Supreme Court is going to make the decision on this. We have conflicting rulings here, and this is probably going to be decided in, we think, in the next year.
They're meeting this Thursday. Are they not meeting tomorrow?
There is a meeting, yeah.
They're meeting tomorrow to determine whether or not they're going to accept the certain cases. And my understanding is that they will probably not even consider this case, because they'd already scheduled sort of the conference in which to make those determinations, although I imagine they will look at it.
I think that's right. And, you know, the schedule that I've heard is that you would go to a hearing in March, and then possibly by the end of June 2012, right in the heat of the presidential campaign, you would get a final ruling on this. Now, one way they could get around that is to use the Brett Kavanaugh argument that this is a tax and you can't yet, nobody's paid the tax and there's no standing, and that would delay any kind of determination on this until 2014. I don't think either side really wants that, but we'll see. That that's a way for the Supreme Court to sort of punt and get out of this.
David Dayan, thank you so much for sticking with us through these technical problems today and reporting on all of this. David Dayan, let's call him the news editor at the news desk on Fire Dog Lake. Appreciate you talking to us today.
Thank you.
All right. Folks, we're going to take a quick break. We come back, we'll be talking to Amanda Turkle from Huffington Post, specifically on the implications of the defeat of SB 5. We'll be right back after this. All right, folks, we are back on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Amanda Turkle from Huffington Post. You're not the owner of Huffington Post, right? You're just you're a reporter for Huffington Post.
That is correct. It is not the Turkle Post.
Okay, right. I just want to clarify that. Amanda, thanks for joining us. So, all right, let's talk about SB 5. This went down to resounding defeat in Ohio, didn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, more than 60% of voters rejected SB 5 and voted no on issue 2. And that wasn't just Democrats. That was Republicans, progressives, independents, you know, across the board. People said they don't like this bill.
Tell us exactly what was in it.
Sure. Well, the most notable provision, the one that people focused on, was that it would have restricted collective bargaining rights for more than 360,000 public employees in the state. And, you know, the fact that it was defeated, it doesn't mean the law is necessarily dead. They now could go back and take bits and pieces and pass it individually. Maybe not on that, but they could do a new bill sort of restricting teacher merit pay, you know, health care provisions. So some of that may still go forward if the legislature decides to do it.
Do you think they would? I mean, politically speaking, I mean, this seems to me to be incredibly toxic in Ohio right now.
Absolutely, and that's what I know union officials were hoping, that they would get a big enough win that it sent a message that said to Republican legislators, look, if you try to go back and pass parts of SB 5, the voters are going to kick you out of office in 2012. So not sure if they're going to do that yet. Governor John Kasich had a press conference last night, and he appeared pretty humbled, and he said, I need to take a deep breath, figure out what my next steps are, and I need to listen to the people, and they rejected this. So we'll see if they try to do that when they reconvene in January.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I was watching that, it struck me as it reminded me of that moment when Alan Greenspan was in front of the Senate saying, I have been living my whole life under the notion of the invisible hand of the free market. And I'm doing some reevaluating.
I mean, it was pretty incredible. You could tell. I mean, the polls had showed that this was going to go down for defeat. But, you know, maybe he was holding out hope until the last minute. But it's definitely embarrassing for him. It had become his signature issue, whether he liked it or not. And the voters just said, you know, we don't like what you're doing. You've overreached.
And there was a tremendous amount of money spent in this election by the sort of pro-corporate, anti-union forces. I mean, unions spent a lot of money, too, and obviously expended a lot of effort. But, I mean, you literally had, in a post-Citizens United world, you literally had Citizens United spending money there.
I mean, more than $35 million was spent on this race, and that was a couple weeks out from the election even. A ton of money on both sides went into this. There were shady tricks. There was the pro-SB5 forces took an ad that the other side had used the same woman and tried to make it seem like she supported their side even though she didn't. I mean, we saw it was a very sort of shady, a lot of shady tricks. It was an interesting race, and both sides recognized the stakes.
Is shady tricks actually a name of a right-wing organization?
I'm surprised it's not Shady Tricks, yeah.
And so you're saying they used a woman who was featured in a anti-SB2 ad. They just hired her to be in the pro-SB2 ad?
They didn't hire her. She was just a normal woman who wanted to praise the firefighters and said, you know, with SB5, this sort of thing wouldn't have been possible. I think it was my granddaughter wouldn't have been saved. So, and then they took her footage and used it in their own ad, and she became the unofficial spokesman for both SB5 and the anti-SB5 forces. And she was pretty upset about it, obviously. And a lot of television stations pulled down the ad, the deceptive ad.
Wow. And so let me ask you this. What does this say to Scott Walker in Wisconsin? I mean, you know, I got to imagine that just the energy of the unions in Ohio, and, you know, certainly when there were big protests in Madison, we were seeing that energy fall into to roll into Ohio, and maybe in many respects, basically launched this anti-SB2 campaign. What does this say to the recall effort in Wisconsin for Scott Walker?
Well, it sends a bad message, I think, to all the Republican politicians who have tried to take on the labor movement and have tried to blame the country's economic problems on the labor movement. I think we're seeing with the number of people who are coming out for the Occupy protests that people aren't blaming unions. They're blaming Wall Street, they're blaming lobbyists, and they're blaming the people who actually have a lot of money and a lot of power. So I think, you know, I think that we will see perhaps now more progressives highlighting the collective bargaining fight more in the Walker recall. And, you know, it's a long way away. A lot of other issues will come up, but it's clear that people in the Midwest and people around the country don't like going after the unions. They just think it's a distraction.
It occurs to me that the implications of – now, this wasn't a special election, but the implications of these sort of off-year elections and special elections over the past just 2 years have been have seemed particularly pointed. You know, Kathy Hochul in New York upstate, I think, is 29th district. Even the Wiener election, the Scott Walker election. There seems to me to be the electorate seems so polarized in some respects that these the narrative shifts on a dime. Is that something that you've struck you as well?
Absolutely. It absolutely shifts on a dime. I mean, Kathy Hochul, it wasn't that long ago, but there it was all about health care, and now it's all about labor. In Mississippi, you know, there was a lot of focus on women's rights. I mean, this is the country is very, very polarized, and trying to figure out what this means for 2012 is incredibly hard to do. So much could happen, so much could change before then. But, I mean, what this did show is that progressives are getting their acts together a bit more on ballot initiatives, which traditionally conservatives have dominated on, passing Proposition 8 in California, which banned same-sex marriage, the taxpayer Bill of Rights, a while ago. Progressives were able to defeat conservative initiatives this time, and then shows that progressives are getting better at this.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to David Dayan about this earlier in the program, and it seems to me that these type of social issues and these, you know, whether it's anti-labor, demonizing teachers, let's say, or anti-gay initiatives or anti-immigration choice issues have been sort of the electoral linchpin for Republicans for years and years and years. And I wonder if this isn't really scaring Republicans. I mean, I don't know how much of this will benefit Democrats, but I wonder if Republicans are sitting back going, you know, what is going to be our strategy to bring out the real base of the party if personhood won't do it, if anti-gay, marriage equality, anti-marriage equality won't do it in Iowa, if anti-immigration won't do it in Arizona. Do you get a sense that this is maybe scaring the Republican establishment in any way?
I think you have an excellent point, because these ballot initiatives are often used in major election years to turn out voters to vote for Republican candidates. So, you know, they care about the initiatives, but they really want to get people out to come and vote for their candidates, and they hope this will boost turnout. And, if people do turn out, but they don't vote the way they want them to, and progressives are able to use this in sort of the opposite way, I mean, like you said, what does that say for the Republican strategy? I mean, one win Republicans did have last night was in Mississippi, where voters approved a voter identification law. So I think we will see Republicans doing this even more, even though they had a loss in Maine on this issue. But it's definitely something Republicans are going after, is this issue of voter rights.
Now, that voter rights, I want to ask you about that, because I wonder if people perceive that as an ideological issue, or it just happens to be one that benefits Republicans.
That's a good question. I mean, I think that voters need to be informed a lot more on this. People still, I think, quite a few of them say, sure, I'll show an ID. You know, what's the big deal about that? And they don't completely understand the motives, the implications, the fallout from that, how hard it is for some people to obtain a government ID, even if they are a legal citizen, you know, that there's not much voter fraud. So I think there's still a lot of education that needs to be done on these issues so people can sort of understand what's happening and see behind them.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think this is it's clearly a loss for because it's going to disenfranchise several hundred thousand people in Mississippi. But I don't know that voters are, A, in general aware of that, and, B, perceive that as a an ideological or anything other than sort of like a practical vote that on its face may seem like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Why would we want, people to show up and vote as someone else, even though they probably aren't aware of the fact that that almost never, ever happens.
Absolutely. And I think in even the vote in Maine where voters said, look, we want to still be able to register to vote on Election Day, which we've been able to do for the last 38 years, but the Republican governor and legislature overturned that. I think a lot of that was practical yesterday. Right. Voters said, look, I want to be able to register on the same day. It's worked for 40 years. Why can't we keep doing it?
Yeah, I think you're right about that. Well, Amanda Turkle, I appreciate your time with us today. And thanks for joining us.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. We got to take that's the end of the show, folks. We're going to head into the better half momentarily. Folks, you can support this program by becoming a member at majority.fm. Oh, so let me just double check this to make sure that I'm correct on this. It's true. We have received no more members. So we did not reach the 10-member threshold in the 24 hours since I laid down the gauntlet. So we will not be doing a 24-hour show on our one-year anniversary. However, because we came close, very close, we were off by, what, 2.5? 3? I don't know what 2.5 is supposed to be.
Great, maybe
2.9. We'll do a 12-hour show next Thursday. That is a week and a day from today. November, what date is that? 17th?
November 17th.
November 17th, we're going to do a 12-hour show. So you will all get a chance to listen to the show live. That's pretty exciting. But on that day, we better get a lot of members. We better get a lot of members calling in. Call in, sure, but also becoming members. Folks, this show exists. 99.9% of our revenue comes from members. 0.05% comes from just money that we find in the elevator. Sometimes people drop a bill or two in there or change. The other 0.05 comes from our sponsor, JustCoffee.coop. Coffee, tea, chocolate, fair trade, co-op. They're in Madison, Wisconsin. They gave coffee to the protesters. Couldn't be a better company to support. Plus, you get a 10% discount with the coupon code MAJORITY. And, of course, you can buy your crap through our Amazon link, and that just sends us maybe, you know, I don't know. I don't know the math. But join me in the better half of the program. You can call me at 646-257-3920, or I am me at Majority FM. And I will issue a correction in the better half of the program regarding some misstatements I made about zygotes and blastocysts. All I can tell you is the devil made me do it. We'll see you in the better half of the program.